Mr. Speaker.
Order, order.
That's David Carter, and he'll be back later in the program to chair the general debate in the Youth Parliament, which, taking advantage of the vacant debating chamber and committee rooms during the second week of this four-week adjournment, kept the heart of democracy beating for 2 days of questions and debate last week. At the same time, though, some of your MPs were at work in the House, as Rhys Lyon reports.
The second week of this four-week parliamentary adjournment saw MPs from three of Parliament's select committees return to Wellington for meetings on Monday and Tuesday, while 138 young people from across the country also convened on the Capitol for this year's Youth Parliament. We'll have more on that later in the program, but first to this week's committee business. The Social Security Legislation Rewrite Bill is a government bill updating the country's social security laws through a rewrite of the Social Security Act 1964. Speaking to the bill's first reading back in May, Social Development Minister Anne Tolley said that it was fitting that after more than 50 years, the historic piece of legislation was refreshed. In a submission to the Social Services Committee on Tuesday, Council of Trade Unions representatives voiced several of their concerns about the bill, with the CTU's General Counsel, Jeff Sissons, outlining opposition to the bill's entrenchment of drug testing requirements for beneficiaries.
Which was introduced in its current form in 2013. Now, the Ministry of Health warned at the time that this change could waste health resources and have an ambiguous overall effect on people's health and overall welfare. Now, those warnings appear to be prophetic to us. MSD notes that approximately 40% of jobs listed with work and income require a pre-employment drug test.
That led Jeff Sissons to make two observations.
First, we accept that some safety-sensitive occupations, like forestry, may justify pre-employment testing. Where being drug-free is not a genuine occupational requirement, then MSD should not permit drug testing of applicants or sanction them for failure.
And the second observation pointed to statistics around beneficiary drug testing.
One out of 200 beneficiaries test positive for drug use. So that's a failure rate of about half of 1%. Testing is an enormous cost for very little benefit. This cost is largely borne by overzealous employers, but encouraging such a waste of money is a reinforcement of wrong and lazy stereotypes. So we say that the Act's drug testing regime should be repealed.
Other concerns with the bill were outlined by Council of Trade Unions senior policy analyst Eileen Brown, who said the bill would make it harder for people to access emergency benefits.
The change now brings in sanctions and work testing and makes accessing an emergency benefit more difficult to people in already difficult circumstances. Emergency or exceptional circumstances are by their very nature unexpected and urgent. And the objective surely is that people in difficult and emergency situations can access the support they need and receive a satisfactory response to their problems as soon as possible.
Eileen Brown also noted a clause in the bill which addresses the government's stated social investment approach to welfare.
We submit against the introduction of the addition of this principle. It's not that we don't support the concept of investment in people, but the Ministry of Social Development social investment model is quite particular. It's new, it's experimental, it's dependent on a limited range of assumptions that haven't been fully evaluated, and it is not evidence-based.
And Eileen Brown also warned that UN conventions on human rights could be breached by another part of the bill,
which imposes financial sanctions if a parent on a benefit fails to identify the other parent of their child. When this is talked about, people are deeply shocked to find this in the legislation. It's highly discriminatory on women, and Māori women in particular, and it's children who bear the awful brunt of this policy. We believe it's a contravention of international human rights, and specifically that the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child is the convention on which a case could be taken. It's a matter of grave social injustice to penalise women for not disclosing the identity of their child's father.
That view was supported by Natalie Thorburn from the National Collective of Independent Women's Refuges.
Women who don't disclose their children's father's details often can't. And the situations why they can't are often really sensitive and difficult to explain. So while we're aware that there's a list of exemptions, such as for rape and incest or for being a victim of family violence, and it's expressly stated, it's one thing to have those provisions available and another to make sure that those women actually are able to access them. And because of the complexities and chaos around these women's situations.
Ms. Thorburn gave an example of how that could play out in practice, based on experience with women's refuge clients.
I'd like you to imagine yourself as Maria, who's a mother of three, had her first child when she was 16, and her two children have the same father, who is a pastor in her family's church. If she was to tell anyone about the situation in which her children were conceived, she would lose all social support, be shamed in her community, and be fearful of resulting violence. But Maria doesn't see what happened as rape, even though she didn't feel like she had the power to say no. She can't prove that there's any situation of violence, because she's never reported it or accessed any kind of services to help with it. She can't ask her family to back it up, because she would be so shamed if she was to disclose that even to them. So she doesn't officially meet any of the criteria for exemption and would never be willing to apply for any of those criteria.
Natalie Thorburn from the National Collective of Independent Women's Refuges with that submission to the Social Services Committee on the Social Security Legislation Rewrite Bill, which is due to be reported back to the Chamber by September the 15th. Also during this second week of a four-week adjournment, the Māori Affairs Committee met behind closed doors on Monday to make progress on business, including several treaty settlements. And the Local Government and Environment Committee also met behind closed doors on Monday for consideration of the Kermadec Ocean Sanctuary Bill. And while those three committee meetings were the only official parliamentary proceedings taking place during the week, the Chamber and several committee rooms hosted the three-yearly Youth Parliament, which has taken place regularly since 1994 when it was first held to mark the 20th anniversary of the lowering of the voting age to 18. Youth Parliament seeks to replicate the real Parliament as closely as possible. Over the course of the two-day event on Tuesday and Wednesday, youth MPs asked oral questions of ministers, participated in a general debate, sat on select committees which report recommendations to the House, and also debated the third reading of a mock bill. Meanwhile, 17 youth press gallery members also attended to report on the proceedings. Among the 121 youth MPs was 18-year-old Timothy Rowe, who was sponsored by National's Whanganui MP, the Deputy Speaker, Chester Burrows. Tom Fruin asked Timothy Rowe how he got to be a youth MP.
First of all, just tell me a little bit about yourself. Where did you go to school?
I went to Whanganui High School. I was a head prefect at Whanganui High School, and I'm from Whanganui originally. Grew up there, and then now I've moved to Wellington to study law and commerce.
At Victoria?
Yes, yeah. At Victoria.
Okay, and how did you become a youth MP?
Oh, well, I actually saw an advert in the paper, and it was for Chester Burrows. He asked youth to write submissions to be chosen for youth MP and explained the outlines, the what it would entail. And I believe there were lots of submissions, but you write a submission to Chester, and Chester will call you up and have a conversation with you. And we answered a few questions. We talked about, at the time, I think Chris Brown was a big issue, about letting him into the country. So we had a talk about that, about a 15-minute conversation. And then he called all of the applicants that he thought could do it. And then at the end, he called me back and said, look, I think you've got the job, but I want to catch up and have lunch or something like that. And so we caught up, had some food, and had another chat about politics, and he picked me for Youth MP.
Right. So this is the second day, is it, of the...
second day of Youth Parliament, yeah.
What have you thought of it so far?
Well, I love arguing, for a start. No. The House on the first day, the question time, was... It got a bit heated, and it was quite fun. It's quite interesting, because we had actual ministers answering questions from... 120-odd youth. And these are 120-odd youth who love picking people apart, breaking down arguments and things like that. And there was a lot of jokes made at the social gathering afterwards that we actually stumped a few of them, with questions that actually could be applied and actually...
A supplementary question, Nathan Wilson.
Does the Minister agree that this regional cycle policy is just a way to help the Greens get from town to town in the 2017 election?
The order, questions in order. The question's in order, the Honourable Nikki Kaye, and a short answer, please.
Mr. Speaker, On behalf of the Minister of Transport, there are lots of political parties love cycling. In fact, I think I can name a good 30 National MPs who get on their bike.
That's right.
These four ministers, they were cabinet ministers, all kind of, I think they went away from it, having learned a little bit about what youth can do.
You got your questions answered or just addressed?
Oh, well, I'm predominantly in the general debate, which is today, and I'm doing a speech to the House.
I call Timothy Rowe, the youth MP for the Honourable Chester Burrows.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I don't want to die. Most of us cannot fully understand the mentality of someone wanting to die. It's for those who can, for those who live in a miserable pain, both physically and emotionally, those who depend on others to complete the simplest human functions. It's because of these people that we must discuss euthanasia.
We did select committee yesterday as well, and learning about the select committee process was really interesting. The fact that the public can just come in and just talk to you, and that you have to analyse and break down their arguments to see if they're actually valid. And I think that, you know, that's a skill that's going to benefit all of us, even if we don't go into politics. So, yeah.
Will you go into politics?
I like politics, and I remember getting the job, and my parents were... I said, oh, yeah, I might go into politics now. And my parents went, awesome. You know, then I've never really considered politics as a viable kind of job because of the chances of getting in. You've got no job security. You know, you're relying on people to vote for you to keep your job. And that's always been a bit kind of weird. It's a weird concept for me. I'm doing law and commerce, and I think that when I finish my degree, I have a better understanding of what I want to do, but I still have no idea. So, you know.
If you went into politics, would you want to go in as an MP? And if you did, would you want to be an electorate MP or a list MP?
I would love to be an MP. Whether I'm a list or electorate, I think if I wanted to get into Parliament, I would probably try as an electorate MP. I'm not affiliated with the party at the moment, and I don't think that's going to change until I get out of university, so I'll have to see how it pans out. I mean, if I wanted to get into Parliament, I'd love to be an MP. I'm not sure what MP.
Right. With an electorate MP, you're representing an electorate, yeah, representing people. With a list MP, you might be able to specialise more in issues.
Mm.
Which do you think that you'd prefer to do? Would you like to represent people or change things?
Well, if I was representing, and I know Chester's the MP for Whanganui, but if I represented Whanganui, I'd be very happy to. I mean, it's an amazing town with amazing people, and I'd love to have that responsibility.
The great American novelist David Foster Wallace once said, "A person in agony will consider killing themselves as an option in the same way in which a trapped person will consider jumping from the window of a burning skyscraper." People around us face a fate worse than that of death, yet the government refuses their right to die. Why? Isn't it moral to give someone a choice to jump rather than force them into the flames? Thank you.
Youth MP Timothy Rowe speaking in this year's Youth Parliament General Debate. Finally, on Monday, the government presented its response to the report of the Justice and Electoral Committee on its inquiry into the last general election on September the 20th, 2014. The committee's inquiry contained several recommendations aimed at updating aspects of the Broadcasting Act regarding election campaign advertising. The committee recommended that the government clarify the difference between an election program and election advertising. Ambiguity in this area led to the ban on the Planet Key satirical video and a lengthy High Court judgment. The committee also reported that TVNZ no longer sees itself as a national public broadcaster and should not be obliged to provide free time for political party broadcasts. Rather than address these recommendations directly, the government is bundling them off to the Ministry of Culture and Heritage for inclusion in an overhaul of the 1989 Broadcasting Act, to be replaced by new legislation called the Digital Convergence Bill. For more on that, stay tuned, as they say.
Reece Lyon, and as you heard earlier, one of the youth MPs, Timothy Rowe, spoke in the general debate on Wednesday afternoon when it was introduced and chaired by the Speaker, David Carter.
We come now to the general debate. Members can speak for up to 3 minutes. on a topic of their choice, and the rules of the debate are set out in Youth Parliament Standing Orders. Relevant sections 19 to 31 apply. Would some honourable member care to move that the House takes note of miscellaneous business? Kane Bassett.
Speaker, I would like to bring forth your attention to the issue of subconscious racism in relation to foreign investment and the role it plays in New Zealand today. This issue has a clear and evident ripple effect on Asian race groupings, and it is my belief that our media is not aiding the situation in the slightest. I would like to offer insight into the area of foreign investment and how this very evidently contributes to the problem of subconscious racism at the forefront. According to a survey conducted on 500 Clutha Southland youth, 430 listed their top two biggest foreign investors as Asian countries. Mr Speaker and youth parliamentarians, our biggest foreign investor is not China and it is not Japan. Our two biggest foreign investors are Canada and Australia. I ask you, Mr Speaker, and the House, why are Kiwis so quick to affiliate foreign investment with Asian racial groupings? Simply, and unjustly so, it is because those of Asian descent are the easiest to differentiate as foreign. And in New Zealand, we hold this warped misconception that New Zealanders have to be white. In addition, New Zealand media institutions have given foreign investment a well-enriched negative connotation as well. Mr Speaker, there is never an article about Canadian foreign investment, and Mr Speaker, there is never a newspaper article about Australian foreign investment, but there is always an article about Asian foreign investment.
The question is that the motion be agreed to. Leah Bell.
Mr Speaker.
Leah Bell.
Humai tira. The New Zealand land wars were pivotal in our nation's and have created the face of race relations today. Do we as a youth parliament understand the living impact of the land wars? Can we say we know why the land wars are our most significant event, leading to such immense loss? Can we understand the significance of the treaty settlement process when we do not know our shared history of the New Zealand land wars? We have living and shared histories of epic and dramatic proportions, with named in ancestors on all sides of the New Zealand wars that have shaped us into who and how we are today. In an attempt to raise awareness about the New Zealand land wars, to introduce these local histories into the New Zealand curriculum, and to memorialise Māori and Pākehā who lost their lives on New Zealand soil with a statutory day of recognition, a petition of more than 11,000 signatures was tabled in this very House by the Honourable Nanaia Mahuta.
Jessica Boniface, Youth Member of Parliament for Jonathan Young.
Mr Speaker and Honourable Youth Members of Parliament, I would like to speak about the declining number of young people in my electorate, New Plymouth. New Plymouth is starting to become more of a place to retire rather than a place to bring up young children. And this is largely due to two main factors. These, to me, are job opportunities becoming scarce for young people without the proper experience, and the biggest reason being that we have no on-site access to a university education. What I believe to be the most significant reason for young people leaving New Plymouth is the lack of a university. Although there is talk of a university expanding to New Plymouth, it still won't be for a few years into the future.
Ruby Bridge,
thank
Member
you, Mr. Speaker.
Of Parliament for James Shaw.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Why should young people become engaged in civic affairs and politics? This year, youth parliamentarians will be considering this question, but today I want to address a slightly different one. Why are we all so disengaged in the first place? Voter participation is in steep decline in New Zealand, particularly with youth, suggesting that we believe our participation can't make a difference. But why should young people become engaged? What difference would it really make? I mean, I never cared much about politics when I was in school because I could never really see how it affected me. I know now. And when I think to myself about why it's important, I like to imagine this. New Zealand is a place where all people have access to the knowledge which explains how politics affects their entire worlds, where there are more effective government services,
because they are informed by youth's opinions and concerns. But do we have access to this knowledge? To some extent, we do. While civics and citizenship is not taught as a separate subject, it's integrated into the criteria of a number of subjects. And that's great, so it's there. But if it's there, then why is there still a decline? Perhaps it's not so much an issue of what we learn and more of an issue of how we learn. Because learning citizenship can't be fulfilled by any set criteria. No, learning citizenship is about nurturing each child's individuality and complex understandings of the world, because that's what citizenship is.
Michael Daya Winterbottom, Youth Member of Parliament for the Honourable Judith Collins.
Tēnā koutou katoa. I hui mai nei i tēnei wā ki ngā kaumātua. Tēnā koutou ki ngā rangatira. Tēnā koutou kai kōrero mā, kai whakarongo mā tautou katoa. I hui mai nei ki te tautaku i tēnei kaupapa. Tēnā koutou katoa. Good afternoon, Mr. Speaker, distinguished guests, and most importantly, youth members of Parliament. Today, we are gathered here to celebrate two things: the democracy which we live in, and our contribution to it as youth. I feel deeply honoured to be part of such an amazing and inspiring group of young people, and to be able to speak to you here today on a topic which is close to my heart, the rights of the LGBT community, both historically and today, with a view towards the future. As a nation, New Zealand has a proud history when it comes to recognising the rights of the LGBT community. In fact, this year marks 30 years since the legislation of homosexual sex between men, a landmark in the fight for equality. This was an important stepping stone in the LGBT rights movement in New Zealand, and having reached the 30-year anniversary of this momentous reform, there is no better time to repeal the convictions of men convicted for having had consensual gay sex before the implementation of this law.
Chloe Destray, Youth Member of Parliament for Lewisa Wall.
My electorate area of Mainarewa is an infamously multicultural, young, low socioeconomic area. My community sees the effects of hardship in their own backyards. As part of my tenure, I held a youth forum with the three high schools in Mainarewa in order to be a true representative of my area. We created mission statements that offer possible solutions to the issues that young people face, including poverty, education, discrimination, and employment. These issues, I believe, are related, forming a multidimensional puzzle that needs to be solved.
I call on Hamish Duncan, Youth Member of Parliament for Clare Curran.
Mr. Speaker, kia ora all. Over my tenure as Clare Curran's Youth MP, I have created and run a survey to gather information on the impact of cyberbullying and how it affects my peers, young men. I believe cyberbullying is more than just a media buzzword. It is a real threat to this country's youth. Cyberbullying is an issue is increasing with the increase in technology. Experts believe that cyberbullying has profound adverse effects: depression, anxiety, suicide, and other antisocial behaviours. Meaning my contemporaries are at risk. With over 700 responses to my survey, I found some very worrying trends. The first is the sheer number of young men being cyberbullied. One quarter of all guys surveyed from year 9 to 13 have been cyberbullied. Think of this extended to the thousands in every year group across the country, and you begin to see the magnitude of the problem. The next worrying statistic is those who have witnessed bullying online. In every single year group, the majority have seen cyberbullying. My peers have observed bullying and been bullied on apps such as Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and many more. In some cases, up to three quarters of a year group have witnessed cyberbullying. Now, when asked whether they would tell anyone if cyberbullied, the majority of every year group would not tell anyone. The government's advice, if you're being cyberbullied, is to first tell somebody. Reach out for help. But young men are incredibly reluctant to do this.
Levi Farrell, Youth Member of Parliament for Carmel Cipollone.
Mr. Speaker and fellow youth MPs, I move the tragedy of a young person dying because of overwhelming hopelessness or frustration devastating to family, friends, and the communities we live in. Parents, siblings, classmates, coaches and neighbours might be left wondering if they could have done something to prevent that young person from turning to the treacherous outcome of suicide. Learning more about what might lead a teen to suicide may help prevent further tragedies. Even though it is not always preventable, it's always a good idea to be informed and take action to help a troubled teenager. Suicide is a serious health and social issue. Suicide rates are a sign of mental health and social well-being of the population of society. Every year, approximately 500 people in New Zealand, 500 people in New Zealand take their own lives, which does not include the various amount of people attempting a suicidal act, experiencing levels of distress that place them at higher risk of suicide. In New Zealand, suicide rates are performed highest by males, as I can see sitting in the house. Also by Māori, as I can see sitting in the house. And lastly, by youth, as I can see sitting in the house.
Katie Gottlieb, Youth Member of Parliament for Materia-Ture.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Parliament has more or less become a playground, a place for the high rollers to throw their toys out of their cot until they get their way. Nowadays, it's a relatively ridiculous notion to expect a well-informed, honest debate in Parliament, and that in itself is one of the many fundamentally dysfunctional things about our democratic system. In Parliament, throwing insults is more commonplace than conscientious decision-making or well-informed debate. And may I say, the insults are pretty below average. In my opinion, and I know that many others agree with me, there is a certain level of respect that must and should be upheld by our leaders of our country. But it seems instead of this happening, our government has just become the butt of a few too many jokes. I will agree, we are a mile off Donald Trump level, but the fact of the matter is, if the general public are no longer shocked when these playground insults are thrown around so casually, or when we discover that Parliament has again been hiding some dodgy dealings behind their $30,000 coldie doors, you would think that there should be some questions asked. One of the things I find so unprofessional about Parliament and its actions is the lack of respect shown to opposing parties. You'd think that everyone would at least listen and respect the opinions of the people they're supposed to be working with to make Aotearoa a better place for us New Zealanders. Because supposedly, the opinions expressed by these parties in our House represent our views and beliefs, what we want for our future, our children's future, and Aotearoa's future. Well, in my opinion, throwing around insults is not representing my views. And insulting the very people you're supposed to be working with is not respectful. And completely disregarding your colleagues' views, even if they are opposing parties, is not only showing a massive amount of disrespect to them, it is showing a massive amount of disrespect to the people of Aotearoa. I'll agree that often what I've been saying does not apply to some of the members of Parliament. Some of our politicians are brilliant people who really are invested in creating the best future for Aotearoa and act accordingly. But unfortunately, a few apparently seem to regard Parliament as playtime. And this creates an environment that is very hard to escape, no matter how many good politicians we have and how hard they try to escape the cycle. What I will say is this. Every single time I've talked to someone about something that has happened on Parliament TV, the conversation without fail ends up being about how disappointed they are about the lack of respect shown and how ridiculous some of the behaviour is. I'm just saying, if so many people from different walks of life actually share this opinion, that kind of points towards there being a wee bit of a problem. Now, I know that all of us here today have very different opinions. We all have very different views and we all support different parties. We all come from different places, all have been brought up differently and all have experienced different hardship. Perhaps you don't agree with some of what I've said, but I think that we can all agree that asking our Parliament, the people who are supposed to be representing all of our differences, asking them to show some respect towards our views and the people who are representing them, now, that is something that shouldn't have to be asked of them. That should be in the damn job description. Thank you.
Youth MP Katie Gottlieb, sponsored by Greens co-leader Materia Ture, speaking in the Youth Parliament General Debate last Wednesday. And we hope to bring you more from that debate next week. I'm Tom Fruin, and this programme was made with funding from Parliament.